Okay, everybody. Welcome to our session on tailored treatment approaches for older patients with advanced HR-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer. Here we're focusing on patients who are older and trying to see how to make treatment decisions and what information we can bring to our practices to try and make decisions. So now it's my pleasure to introduce Neil Iyengar, who's going to talk about assessing patients who are older with advanced HR-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Rugo, and good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Dr. Rugo, and to the organizers, PER, for the invitation. So I'm very glad that we're having this session because I think the primary issue in terms of assessing, historically, in terms of assessing our older patients or the classical geriatric population, of course, is that we relied predominantly on less well-defined measures or more subjective measures of function, both physical function as well as all the various domains that we'll go through in the subsequent slides. What I'd like to show you now is some data with regard to the population distribution and how that impacts who we treat in breast cancer, but also how we may more formally assess various parameters of our patient's functional status, not just rely on age, and use those assessments to then inform our treatment-making decisions. So with that being said, we'll do that in the context of a case. And I'll introduce this case to you. This is a 70-year-old female who presents with newly diagnosed de novo metastatic breast cancer involving the thoracic lymph nodes as well as osseous metastases involving her sacrum and right ischium. I didn't provide details on the symptomatology here, but let's say for the sake of discussion, she is having some low-grade pain in those areas. She's had chronic low back pain, and it has particularly intensified over the course of the last few months, which prompted her presentation. She then underwent a CT-guided core biopsy of one of the thoracic lymph nodes, and this confirmed metastatic breast cancer, hormone receptor positive, strongly positive, with ER at 95%, PR 80%, and HER2 non-amplified. In terms of her comorbidities, you can see in the third bullet point there, she does have some. Those include non-insulin dependent diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and GERD. So we have essentially a representation of metabolic syndrome here, which the majority of the population at that age has. She has an ECOG performance status of 1. She is independent at home, and she is fairly active. And she would like to be treated, of course, but she is concerned, understandably, on the impact on her quality of life. So let's start with some discussion questions to keep in mind here to contextualize some of the data I'll show you in the subsequent slides here. And that is that we'll be focused on what are some of the unique challenges that our older patients face, particularly those with metastatic breast cancer. I think the conversation is certainly a bit different when we're talking about a more chronic situation, and some of the life expectancy discussions really come into the forefront. The second question here is, do we have all of the information that we need to accurately assess this patient for treatment? So I essentially showed you her bare bones history here, and we'll get into some of the tools that are available to better assess our patients that are in the geriatric population with more objective approaches. So just some population data here. This is SEER data here, but I don't think I need to belabor this for this crowd. We all know that breast cancer is, or as most cancers are, a disease of aging. And so breast cancer is more common in older women. You can see here that 46% of women are diagnosed, or 46% of breast cancers are diagnosed after age 65. Now, interestingly, I'll just point out here that in the 2019 American Cancer Society report, we saw trends whereby the diagnosis or the incidence of breast cancer in the older populations, the older cohorts, are flattening and even reducing slightly in some of the older cohorts. However, in our youngest cohorts, in the late 20s and early 30s, we're actually seeing an upslope in the incidence curve for those populations. And this is not a session focused on young breast cancer, but something to keep in mind here, that the patterns or the demographics of breast cancer are, in fact, evolving before our eyes here. Unfortunately, 38% of breast cancer deaths occur in those that are age 75 or above. And this has to do a little bit with just simply where a person is in their journey, right? Their life expectancy, essentially. But it also has to do with the biology of the disease. And what we see in younger women diagnosed with breast cancer, the tumor behavior certainly is different. But I would add to that that response to therapy is probably the greater factor contributing to outcomes or the poorer outcomes in the geriatric population here. And this has to do with treatment selection, but also has to do with treatment modification and toxicities associated with treatments that can be compounded in certain circumstances for our older patients here. Nonetheless, there on the slide, I've listed for you the 5-year survival by age there, and that sort of demonstrates the point here that we see essentially slightly lower survival rates for those that are in the eldest age group category of 75 or above. I think the bigger point to keep in mind here, too, is that many of our older patients will be living with a breast cancer diagnosis. Specifically, we're talking about metastatic breast cancer, will be living with a breast cancer diagnosis for years. And I think this brings to the forefront the focus on quality of life, not only mitigating toxicity, but making sure that we're having those conversations with our patients, and having some objective risk factors and data can be helpful in those conversations. The other, or to further exemplify the point on the last slide here, again, coming from SEER data, and this is from Dr. Claire Friedman, what you can see here is, as expected, outcomes by stage, of course, are associated with outcomes, but certainly every stage in those patients that are 75 years or older, unfortunately, are associated with worse outcomes in that age group compared to those in younger cohorts. Again, suggesting that it's really the management of the treatments that we offer to our patients that are likely contributing not only to quality of life, but to outcomes as well. So I alluded to this earlier, and that is that our older patients do face unique challenges. I would argue that perhaps the first challenge that they face is perhaps a knee-jerk assessment by age. I think that geriatric oncology as a field has really helped us to better understand the heterogeneity in our older patients, and that we really must define, as the majority of you responded in the pre-questions, we really must define the candidacy of our older patients for various cancer treatments, not by their age, and not even by their functional assessment assessed in a clinic visit, but really tools that are more precise in understanding their risk for toxicity, including more serious toxicities, but also their risk for lowering quality of life so that we can have those conversations in clinic with our patients and aid in mutual decision making. So here you can see, of course, some of these are pretty straightforward, and we all see this in clinic. We do know that our older patients, particularly those with comorbidities, are at higher risk for toxicity. And importantly, more severe toxicity. We also know that functional decline can be more rapid in our older patients because they're starting off oftentimes with a lower reserve, not always, but often. And the timeline considerations for risk and benefit might be different in some of our older patients. I alluded to this earlier when I mentioned the life expectancy discussion, and I think this is something that, at least in my experience, my older patients tend to bring up much more frequently and are really understandably more concerned about their quality of life. And then finally, caregiver preferences. If you're treating a patient who's reliant on a caregiver, maybe because of a comorbidity, how our treatments impact that comorbidity, and more specifically, the caregiving requirements, are an important part of that discussion. Additionally, at the bottom here, what you can see that the risk of recurrence, of course, is something that we talk about with all of our patients, but I think the risk-benefit analysis in our older patients is particularly important here, and if we can, you know, in the ideal conversation, we can really try to give the patient a sense of what their recurrence risk might be. Now, this is, of course, we're not talking about the metastatic setting for this point, but if you're talking to an early-stage patient, I think it can be quite helpful to really try to maybe not nail down the exact numbers, but try to give the patient a sense of what their risk of recurrence might be so that they can really make an informed decision in terms of what they're willing to put up with in terms of toxicity. And I'll show you in the next few slides how we can use some of our risk assessment tools for treatment-related toxicity to aid in that risk-benefit decision-making. Now, in the metastatic setting, you know, this discussion is a bit different here, and we're certainly talking more about progression and the timeline to progression here. And I think, at least in my own experience, the conversation is more related to how long can we stick with more tolerable therapies before we get to a point where we're really having to decide whether or not you would just want to stop therapy or put up with some of the more toxic treatments that may come in later lines of therapy. And so the next set of questions to keep in mind here is how do we actually objectively define some of what I've been talking about here? And that is what additional information can help us in both the patient but us as the clinician, what can help us make those decisions and really have a more clearly defined risk-benefit discussion with our patient. And we'll get into some of the tools that are available to us. So Dr. Hurio is one of course, the pioneers in establishing folks in the geriatric oncology field. And the development of the geriatric assessment has really evolved over time. And unfortunately, now we're in a place where a lot of these are calculators that you can use and provide you with some hard scores or numbers here. But I want to start with the geriatric assessment because it really highlights the multiple parameters that we need to keep in mind when making treatment decisions for our patients. So if, certainly functional status, we all assess this even when watching our patients. And there are various functional assessments that have been associated not only with cancer-specific prognosis, but with all-cause mortality and with patient-reported outcomes and quality-of-life parameters as well. And particularly, some of these that are listed on here that I use, like the timed get-up-and-go test, I think can be helpful in really understanding a patient's reserve and how our treatments may or may not impact their reserve. The number of falls in the last month can also be helpful and is sort of related to their performance scale, although we do also we've also seen data that the variability in using various performance scales, such as the Karnofsky scale or even the ECOG scale, can vary quite widely from clinician to clinician. And so this is partly why I like to use some of the more precise tools like the get up and go test, where you assign a time or a score that is a little bit more objective. Comorbidity scores, of course, are also important here, and you'll see some of this is incorporated into the risk assessment tools. Polypharmacy is a major issue in our older patients here, not just for interactions, but also considering how some of the toxicities or adverse effects of cancer therapy might be exacerbated by certain medications that might be required for the management of comorbidities. Certainly psychological status, and I think the concept of mortality really becomes central in the discussion, particularly in the metastatic setting, and particularly for our older patients, so keeping in mind how this might impact or whether they have baseline psychological conditions or alterations that may impact how they filter this information, and certainly their nutrition status. Unintentional weight loss is one of our top markers of poor outcomes, and whether or not a patient has sarcopenia or cachexia can also contribute to prognosis and what their metabolic response to therapy might be. And then finally, the social functioning and the social support that a patient has available to them we are now seeing increasing data indicating how critical a patient's social support is, not just to their quality of life, but to their cancer-specific outcomes as well. So this is the Cancer and Aging Research Group breast cancer-specific model that was validated in the HOPE cohort study. This was the Hurria older patients cohort study. Originally, when the CARG model was developed, this was intended primarily for chemotherapy and understanding what the risk of toxicity might be from cytotoxic therapies, particularly in GI cancers. This study helped to advance the scoring, particularly in breast cancer, and especially in the metastatic setting where we don't often use polychemotherapy. But again, just keeping in mind that this scoring system was initially developed specifically for chemotherapy toxicity risk assessment. But here you can see that there are several factors. Now, this particular model does not apply to the metastatic setting. You can extrapolate it. It was validated in early stage cancers. And I'll show you later some tools that do apply or have been developed for the metastatic setting. Use of anthracyclines, the treatment duration, baseline bone marrow and organ function, and then functional status assessments, including falls, how fit a patient is, which is assessed by their walking, and then finally, their social situation. Do they have a fallback person who's available to them? The sum score is divided into low, intermediate, and high risk, and can really give you an idea of how a patient may cope with the toxicity of our therapies. I know this is a little small here, and I'm running a little behind on time, so I'll sum this up by saying that this scoring model was associated, the low, intermediate, and high score groups were associated in a stepwise fashion with the risk of all of the parameters that you see listed on this slide here. That's toxicity, hospitalizations, dose modification, including early treatment discontinuation. So the score is useful in terms of prediction. There are other scoring systems that are also available. Many of these are available and can be pre-built into electronic health systems. So these can be incorporated into your standard of care scoring approach, the geriatric or G8 screening tool. The Vulnerable Elders Survey and the Frailty Scale can provide slightly different perspectives in terms of the risk of your patient. And then I think ultimately what we need to, of course, keep in mind, and I was pleased to see this response on the pre-questions, is that the efficacy of our treatments can be just as good, if not better, in the older population. But of course, this is potentially mitigated by the specific risks. So why do our assessment tools help? Well, this is all listed on the slide here and has been validated and ultimately has been incorporated into the ASCO guidelines for the approach to patients in the geriatric population. I'll finally leave you with this before I turn it over to Dr. Jhaveri, and that is that whole person care we know is critically important to the quality care for our patients with cancer, not just in the survivorship setting, but also in the metastatic setting. And we and others have done a lot of work demonstrating that if you are able to provide a multidisciplinary intervention, you can not only improve quality of life parameters, but cancer-specific outcomes as well. And if you want to find out more, this is a project we've recently started, which allows for a virtual whole-person care clinic to be embedded in community clinics. You can go to the website listed on the slide there. So I hope I've given you a brief primer on geriatric risk assessment tools. And with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Jhaveri, who will take us to through the therapeutic approach.
Thank you so much for setting the stage, Neil. So now let's talk about data and efficacy pertaining specifically to the older patient population here. You'll start seeing a theme as we show so many slides with so many data, and you'll see a common theme emerge, and you know we'll review them together. But essentially, when you're thinking about treating metastatic breast cancer in older patients, different treatment schedules, dose reductions, or stepwise dose escalation before reaching standard recommended dose might be required in older patients to reduce the risk of adverse outcomes. It's really, really important, as we learned from Dr. Iyengar, that evaluation of comorbidities, the performance status, the geriatric assessments are crucial and more relevant just than the chronological age. Age is just a number. Many other factors matter. And special attention should be given to potential drug interactions in view of polypharmacy by older patients as well. Minimizing side effects, which we know is a priority for all patients younger or older, particularly becomes more relevant in the older patient population. And at least when it comes to data from chemotherapy, similar to what we've learned in metastatic breast cancer, single drug regimens are preferred over polychemotherapy. And in fact, we have seen, specifically in the older patient population, data with nab-paclitaxel and eribulin to be safe and effective as well. So what about CDK4/6 inhibitors? This is PALOMA-2. I think we're very well aware of the PALOMA-2 study evaluating letrozole and palbociclib in the first-line metastatic setting. This was an exploratory analysis planned in patients age 65 or older. And here you see on the top is the intent-to-treat patient population. The blue is the palbociclib arm. The bottom is the age group 65 and older, and you'll see that PFS is prolonged in older patients, similar to what we saw in the ITT patient population, if anything, slightly longer, but the hazard ratios are similar. When we look at overall survival, similar to what we had seen with intent-to-treat patient population, there is a numerical improvement in overall survival with the addition of palbociclib, but not statistically significant. The same holds true even in the elderly patient population, at least in the Paloma 2 trial. Paloma 3 was evaluating fulvestrant with palbociclib. This is the second-line patient population, patients who've had progression on an aromatase inhibitor. Again, similar theme that we're seeing, that age is just in, a number in this case. When we think about this exploratory analysis and look at PFS, PFS was actually numerically even prolonged. The middle bar is the age group 65 to 74. The hazard ratio there is 0.27. I would say the numbers are small, but if anything, you can see the blue bars are longer than the gray bars, meaning the addition of palbociclib was seen, and you're seeing that regardless of age group. The bottom is small numbers, but this is age 75 and older receiving the combination as well when you see the benefit. This is overall survival data from Paloma 3. Again, you see a benefit with the addition. It is not significant, similar to intent to treat. But the idea is, regardless of age, you're seeing the benefit with the addition of CDK4/6 inhibitor, in this case with palbociclib. Now, what about abemaciclib? Should that be any different? This was PFS by age subgroup in the MONARCH 2 and MONARCH 3 trials. Again, consistent benefit. On the top row is MONARCH 2, bottom is MONARCH 3. The left column, if you will, is the less than 65 age group. The middle is 65 to 75, and then 75 and older is on your right. And the red bars are the addition of abemaciclib, and you see that the addition of abemaciclib benefit is seen regardless of the age group analysis. Certainly, if you start looking at the smaller numbers, you'll see that the confidence intervals are crossing one, especially if you look at, say, the age 75 and older, and even 65 and 74. But these are small sample sizes, but at least numerically, you see that the benefit is maintained. Similarly, when we look at the ribociclib program across the MONALEESA 2, 3, and 7 trials, a PFS benefit was observed across all age groups, as shown in the three figures here by age, and a similar relative reduction in the risk of disease progression or death was observed regardless of age, as shown in less than 65, 65 to 75, and 75 and older groups. This is the OS benefit with ribociclib. Again, a consistent OS benefit has been observed across all age groups. Ribociclib plus endocrine therapy prolonged median overall survival by about 16 months in the less than 65, approximately 13 months in the 65 to 75 age group, and 9.3 months in the 75 or older age group compared with placebo. The numbers, as I said, start getting smaller when we break these down by age groups, and the confidence intervals start crossing one, but at least we're seeing a similar-ish benefit when it comes to efficacy across these analyses. So the FDA did a pooled analysis across all three CDK4/6 inhibitors from the Paloma, MONALEESA, and MONARCH 3 trial, and bottom line is that similar efficacy with the CDK4/6 inhibitor in combination with AI compared with AI alone in the first-line metastatic setting in older patients compared to younger patients. So just because you have an older patient does not mean the benefit is not going to be obtained with the addition of a CDK4/6. Not only do we have these prospective data sets, exploratory or pooled analyses, we have real-world data sets. This is an effort that HOPE led, actually, with palbociclib in the real-world data set. Again, when we're looking at unadjusted real-world PFS shown on your left, or we're looking at the adjustments for confounding factors that we use statistically with shown on your right, you're again seeing the benefit in 65 or older age group for progression-free survival, even in this real-world data set. And the overall survival data, at least in this real-world data set, was also statistically significant and, again, demonstrated the efficacy of this approach, unadjusted and adjusting for the confounding factors in this real-world data. We also have SEER data in Medicare population of patients with de novo hormone receptor positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer. And again, you're seeing this unadjusted overall survival benefit even in this analysis. So really, all of this is just trying to tell us the same thing. There is a benefit regardless of age, at least when we think about efficacy from CDK4/6 inhibitors for our patients. Napalum Age was a study which was a non-interventional, real-world prospective study. It's a French multicenter study. It had two cohorts, about 800 patients, half of which were endocrine-sensitive, getting first-line therapy. That cohort B was endocrine-resistant disease. And the primary outcome for this study was looking at the 18-month palbociclib discontinuation rate. And we're going to focus on the cohort A group. There were many secondary objectives looking at time to treatment failure, quality of life, and geriatric assessments, and we'll go about that to see what we learned from this experience from the French cohort. So the median time to failure in this cohort A endocrine-sensitive patient population was about 23 months, and the median real-world PFS was about 30 months. This is about 164 patients that experienced disease progression or death. And at the end of the study, 94% of the patients were still alive and 39% still continuing the palbociclib treatment. They did univariate analyses looking at multiple factors, including higher age groups, looking at performance status. They looked at the geriatric assessment scores and they scored them less than equal to 14 or higher. They looked at sites, a number of sites of metastatic involvement, absence of a caregiver or social support. And when they looked at multivariate analyses that looked into all of these factors, the risk of treatment failure was significantly higher with impaired geriatric assessment scores and for those lacking a caregiver or a support. So really, overall, the study showed that the benefit was similar in terms of effectiveness or efficacy when we compare it to younger patients, but it really highlighted the necessity of tailoring treatment approaches based on geriatric assessments and relying not just only on the age. It also informed us about the social support and the importance of social support that can significantly influence treatment continuation and patient outcomes. Additionally, in the exploratory analyses, when they looked at fixed dosing of initiation. So approximately 80% of the patients started at the standard of care dose of 125 milligrams, 14% at 100 milligrams, and 6% at 75 milligrams. When patients had a fixed initiation dose, patients with impaired geriatric assessment scores exhibited a higher discontinuation rate at 18 months and a shorter time to treatment failure. Again, highlighting the need that maybe for some patients, we don't have to stay at that fixed initiation dose and we might need to make some adjustments. Sorry, I went backwards. There we go. Another experience that we can share with palbociclib was from a cooperative group effort. This is Mina Cedric and in his work through the Alliance Cooperative Group, focusing on age 70 and older with hormone receptor positive breast cancer, no prior CDK4/6 inhibitor. They also wanted to accrue 75 plus patients as well, about 40 patients. And so these patients received palbociclib or endocrine therapy, could have been letrozole or fulvestrant. And the primary outcome was to look at grade 3 toxicities by six-month time point and multiple other secondary and exploratory endpoints as shown here. And just to kind of sum it up in terms of what we learned from this experience is that asymptomatic neutropenia and leukopenia were the most common grade 3 toxicity, similar to what we have seen in the other Paloma trials. There was an interesting finding about higher BMI being associated with a lower risk of grade 3 toxicities. I thought that was interesting. 35% required dose reductions and interruptions, and 15% had early discontinuations or hospitalizations due to adverse events. For patients 75 and older, there was a trend towards higher rates of early discontinuation and hospitalization due to adverse events compared to the group that was less than 70 years of age, or 70 to 74. And efficacy was comparable to prior data and did not differ by age group. So while efficacy was similar and there was some asymptomatic neutropenia and leukopenia, there were some findings about the 75 and older group having a higher trend in these small group of patients. I'll end with this effort that ASCO has. It's called the ASCO CDK study. And really, I think what it really wants to focus on, when we think about drug development, we think about maximum tolerated dose. And this is how we've been developing drugs for many agents, including chemotherapy, where it has been, you know, the highest acceptable dose is what we choose, and that's what we use as the standard dose in larger trials. But I think the importance of trying to shy away from that and think about biologically active dose might be more relevant. And this is something that we're now adapting, and we've done that with oral SERDs, for example, where we go after a biologically effective dose and not just the maximum intolerable dose or tolerable dose. And real-world data and ASCO patient-centered dosing initiative, surveys have shown that CDK4/6 inhibitors may be started at a lower dose to avoid toxicity. In fact, we've seen some analyses that even when you lower the dose, you're not really losing out on efficacy. There have been trials in the metastatic setting. A good study is AMELIE, which has looked at 400 milligram dosing compared to 600 milligram dosing of ribociclib and did show that the toxicity profile kind of matched. It did not meet its primary endpoint, but that was a very distinct primary endpoint, but the toxicity was better. In fact, the 400 milligram dose is what we use in the adjuvant setting in the NATALEE trial, and this is some data that has supported that. So patients who really encounter a major toxicity at treatment initiation are also the ones that are likely to discontinue. So to avoid that, I think this is kind of an initiative. And so this ASCO CDK study had a hypothesis of titrating the dose of CDK4/6 inhibitors that could allow older patients to tolerate treatment better and stay on treatment longer and derive more benefit from treatment, with a primary objective of comparing time to treatment discontinuation of CDK4/6 inhibitors defined as the time from randomization to the known dose that the patient started on. So this is the study schema. You have arm one, that is the indicated dose, the FDA-approved dose. So with palbociclib, it would be 125, or with ribociclib, it's 600. Arm two is the titrated dose. Start at a lower dose of 100 or 75 for palbo, or 400 and 200, and escalate as tolerated. And the primary endpoint here would be to look at, as I said, time to treatment discontinuation, and also focus on some patient-centered treatment-related outcomes, which I think are going to be very, very important, and looking at PROs, as shown here on the table on the right. This is an interesting patient preference survey conducted by Erica Mayer at the Dana-Farber Institute. This is a web-based survey in about 400 patients with stage 2 or 3 ER-positive, HER2-negative early-stage breast cancer, where patients were really asked about their preferences for therapy based on factors like efficacy, adverse events, number of blood tests that might be required, requirement for EKG monitoring, treatment duration, scheduling, what factors matter to them in terms of choice of therapies. And the highest ranking in terms of this survey there was for increased efficacy, lower toxicity, and shorter treatment duration. Number of blood tests, EKG monitoring, or treatment schedule was not that important, at least in this web-based survey that patients participated in. So I think to put all of this into context, I'll summarize that later, but we have this case that maybe we can talk about. A 70-year-old patient with non-insulin-dependent diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and GERD with an ECOG of performance status of 1 was deemed an appropriate candidate for systemic therapy. What first-line treatment would you recommend for this patient and why?
All right, so we're going to go through the toxicity now. And just look at what information we've had in older patients. And one of, I think, the most helpful analyses was this FDA-pooled analysis that looked at higher rates of adverse events and dose modifications, as well as a decrease in quality of life in older patients. Now, I think the importance of this data, which is the AI data, so it's first line, is that it was very early in the course. I mean, these are all the trials. It was published in 2019, so you know I think we're better at managing the toxicity of many of these of these CDK4/6 inhibitors now that we've understood that. But if you just look at, you know, for example, AEs leading to discontinuation or dose reduction and interruption, it's really the AEs leading to discontinuation rather than interruption that are increased in patients who are older. So if you look at 70 as the cutoff, you know, more than doubles. And if you look at less than 75 versus greater than 75 as the cutoff, it almost triples. So, you know, there really is a lot more discontinuation in older patients. And, you know, it's interesting because when you look at the various factors, I mean, there's a little more fatigue, you know, you're looking at grade 3, but it's not that much different. So, you know, it's an interesting question. I mean, are you really seeing a lot more toxicity, or are you just seeing that people feel the side effects more and so they discontinue a little bit more? I mean, there certainly is more grade 3, 4. If you just look at the grade 3, 4 toxicity also at the top, you can see that it's about 12% higher, less than 70 or 70 and older, and then it's considerably higher when you get to 75 and older compared to less than 75, so 73 versus 89% have grade 3, 4 toxicities. I think for a lot of us, when we're looking at these toxicities, it's, you know, fatigue and some of those other issues that are a little bit harder for us to manage, although we can talk about it here. So here's a pooled analysis of women who are 65 and older with adverse events reported in the Paloma trials. And if you look at the greater than 75 years of age, you can see the hatched line is endocrine therapy, and the dark black line filled in is palbo combination. But it's, you know, 32 versus 83 patients. So it's really small numbers because just of the smaller numbers of patients that go into trials. But you can see that that solid black line is higher for some of the different areas of toxicity than is the hatched line, some of it being bone marrow suppression, as you would expect with palbociclib, but other toxicities as well tend to be a little bit more. Interestingly, like if you look at arthralgias, I'm not sure you can pick it out there, but on the farther right, it's almost identical, right, even in the older patients. So this is all AI-driven and not driven by the CDK4/6 inhibitor. And then Palomage did a safety analysis, and overall, palbociclib endocrine therapy was well tolerated in women who were 70 years or older, median follow-up of 2 years. And but the 18-month discontinuation rate of palbociclib was 41%. If you look at the reasons for discontinuation, half of the patients discontinued for disease progression, but 18% for toxicity, and then 17% patient choice. And you've got to figure that toxicity and patient choice have to be pretty closely related here. And I think that we can get over that. We don't need to have our older patients discontinue effective therapy. We just have to work with them with dose reductions, managing side effects, changing drugs if we need to. There's a lot of different ways that we can work with our older patients. Obviously, if patients are really not tolerating drug, the benefit that people are getting in PFS is offset by their decrement in quality of life. So we have to think about that when we're making recommendations. So now, this is a phase two prospective trial in the Alliance, and you heard some about Cedric's work already, but they looked at patients who were older with palbociclib, used standard dose, 125 milligrams, and for any grade adverse events, there was just more toxicity in the older patients, particularly those who were 75 and older. Had less, which was interesting in this particular study, than those who were 70 to 74. So really fascinating, and it suggests that when we're going to give targeted therapy to an older population, that we select patients who tolerate it well, and we maybe don't do as good a selection when patients are a little bit younger. These are small numbers, but it is quite intriguing. When they looked at patients who were 75 years or older, they saw more specific toxicities, anemia due to less bone marrow cells, neuropathy and anorexia. So there were some differences between these patient populations, but again, the numbers were quite small in order to make that differentiation. And then here are the risk factors associated with toxicity. And I was just talking to somebody about eribulin toxicity. And, you know, people have high BMI. We don't really understand the volume of distribution of most of the drugs we're giving, right? And so you may see really enhanced toxicity in patients with a high BMI. And, in fact, high BMI here was associated with more toxicity, probably because of comorbidities, is my guess, in the Alliance trial. So, and you can see that in that very difficult to read table there below. But it's generally true for most of the drugs we give that we see more toxicity unless we dose reduce, and we don't know how to dose reduce. This just outlines the dose interruptions and delays, dose reductions by age. And what you can see here is the overall, remember these are patients age 70 or greater. Dose reductions were very similar across that age group. Dose interruptions and delays, you see a little bit more, 10% more in the patients who are 75 years or older, although small numbers. And a marked increase in hospitalization in older patients. Now, again, this may be due to the cancer itself, comorbidities and issues like that, but it was a pretty big difference in the older patients with hospitalizations. In general, I have to say for my older patients who are on drug, you know, I have a very low threshold for dose reducing or starting low, but also their hospitalizations generally associated with disease progression issues rather than issues associated with drug toxicity, at least in the population that I treat. So this is the Mona Lisa 2, 3, and 7, and you can see here, I mean, this is something that we talked about earlier. You know, it's hard because in one trial they were looking at premenopausal patients, but I tried to highlight the one place where there was a little bit of a difference when you look at grade 3, 4. So the left-hand side of the less than 65 and the right is all grade 3, 4. Same for 65 to 75 or 75 years or older. And so you're really looking at comparing the grade toxicities between these two groups, which I find this particular one is a little bit hard to read. But if you look at the all grade, just all grade, you can see you go from 9% to 11%, 9% to 11%, 16% for QT prolongation. And that's, you know, something that's really important to think about, because older patients are at higher risk for QT prolongation. They take more concomitant meds. And that's an issue. Interestingly, no difference in ILD because the rates are low with these CDK4/6 inhibitors. I think in older patients, there's no particular increased risk there. If you looked at infections and looked at the grade 3-4 infections, I have to say, you know, no real difference there, so that's encouraging. The other area where there looked like there might be some trend, but it's a little hard, it's an all-grade toxicity, was looking at hepatobiliary toxicity, and that may be, again, because of this hepatic steatosis being a little bit higher as in aging patients. It was interesting that in these trials, there wasn't really an increase in grade 3-4 neutropenia, which had been seen in the pooled analysis by the FDA. So, again, it may be that as the trials went on, we were a little bit better in managing the neutropenia in these patients and not seeing more. Again, this is the dose modifications due to adverse events by age. And you can see that as you get to the older patients, one dose reduction or greater wasn't really very different across the studies. And again, it's important to keep in mind, this isn't the real world, right? So in the studies, it's all mandated when you dose reduce. So it was relatively equivalent. But again, if you looked at the discontinuations, it's a huge difference, right? So 41% in the 75 years or older, 20% in the 65 to 75 versus 15% in the less than 65. And then the other important point is how many people discontinued without even reducing their dose. So 50% for the 75 and older and 34% for the less than 65. Now, what's fascinating is these are the metastatic trials. This is identical to what we saw in the adjuvant trials. People just stopped drug. They didn't dose reduce. So it's really important to keep this in mind, because in our older patients, again, we're not treating them on a study. You want to start them on a lower dose, great. If I'm giving an older patient a abemaciclib, I'm starting them at 100 BID because I don't want to deal with bad diarrhea. I can always go up on the dose. So I think it's really important not to discontinue treatments that can make a big difference for patients in terms of their disease control and outcome, but reduce the dose. So these are just the pooled adverse events, and I showed some of them in MONARCH 2 and 3. Interestingly, here there was a little bit more neutropenia. I mean, regardless of what all these studies show where you select the best patients, I think that overall the real-world data suggests that older patients do have more neutropenia with all of these agents and certainly more discontinuations, as I mentioned earlier. So this trial is actually going to provide prospective data on abemaciclib-based endocrine therapy in later-line metastatic breast cancer, and it's for abemaciclib and endocrine therapy in patients 70 or older with HR-positive metastatic disease progressing on or after a prior CDK4/6 inhibitor. This trial actually has been accruing for a while, so when I looked into the NCI site, it still says it's open to accrual, but maybe with the most recent data with post-MONARCH, et cetera, there'll be more enthusiasm and be able to treat these patients more and come to a conclusion. I think it's quite an interesting question. So I think what we've learned is that CDK4/6 inhibitors have the same efficacy in older patients and younger patients. For the most part, they're tolerable with some differences in toxicity. But the major issue is that people aren't being treated in the real world as much, and they're stopping drug without dose reducing. Then we have to select the appropriate systemic treatment in older patients to assess the risk of disease and assess for frailty and an in-depth geriatric assessment if positive, and then adjust the regimens, doses, and schedules accordingly. Start low and go slow approach. And I think patient preferences matter a lot for these patients. You know, what's the most important thing for those patients? So now we're going to return to the case. So this 70-year-old woman is started on a CDK4/6 inhibitor and letrozole, but we're going to try and deal with a few of the different questions that were brought up here. So the first is, what would you choose for this patient who had some comorbidities? So, Neil.
Is this on? Can you hear me? Okay, great. So I think the answer is there, and I agree. You know, I think this for this particular patient and the comorbidities that she had, you know, I certainly would have a conversation with her about some of the increased risks that she has for neutropenia, for metabolic dysfunction. Nonetheless, the benefit of the CDK4/6 inhibitor combination plus letrozole it would still, in this case, outweigh the risk of that treatment. So I agree with this therapy. I think perhaps the deeper conversation could also be, what CDK4/6 inhibitor would you choose? Ah, that is the question. Okay.
What CDK4/6 inhibitor?
So I would, this is for this patient population with this type, with these comorbidities, I would choose palbociclib. I would reach for the CDK4/6 inhibitor that is least likely to have drug-drug interaction, that's least likely to have QTC prolongation, as you alluded to, which is a higher risk for this population, and that is also most likely to pair well. I mentioned drug-drug interaction, but most likely to pair well with new medications that need to be added on to manage comorbidities, which is something that I think we should be thinking of upfront.
Komal, what would you do if somebody has a grade 2 neutropenia at 2 weeks?
2 weeks, usually, if that is grade 2 neutropenia, I just watch how bad of the neutropenia that is and just continue monitoring. And, you know, we can hold that dose and we can still continue monitoring the way we normally do with CDK4/6 inhibitors. It's, again, with that hold or with that monitoring that you do, again, what happens a week later when they have this intermittent dose schedule and they are in their off week and they come back again and check there and whether they're neutropenic. If it's persistently that and you're, you know, continuously holding, that's when you want to lower the dose, because that's what this is going to need for them to be able to stay on the drug for a long time. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to get the durability of staying on the drug for a long time. And I think depending on the medications that they're on for their comorbidities and whether there are interactions or not, certainly palbociclib becomes an easy choice in terms of not having that interactions, or if the medications are not necessarily that interfering, ribociclib could be appropriate as well. So I think I've done both, and depending on how many medications and what medications they are on and whether they will interact or not, I've chosen palbociclib and ribociclib. But overall, I feel like when it comes to interactions and multiple issues, palbociclib seems to be an easier one in terms of not worrying about that issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because grade 2 neutropenia, of course, is neutrophils over 1,000, so we don't care about neutrophils over 1,000. So
that's what I'm saying. I would continue like I would
more.
Normally.
And we're happy with that, and I think that's the issue. And do you usually, when somebody's neutropenic at day 28, you know, as I'm always like, do not check your labs on day 27. Don't go first thing in the morning. You know, and a lot of my patients,
I do that.
They come far away. Yeah. They do jumping jacks. So they run up. And
I
down the stairs.
I make them go up and down the stairs. Yeah. Yes, I do.
Big difference. I'm just telling you.
It's so diurnal, and it changes with exercise. There's marginalization of the neutrophil. So I literally make them repeated before I actually make an.
And there are actually data to support this. So we do see that the rates of neutropenia. Now, it wasn't demonstrated with CDK4/6 inhibitors, but chemotherapy induced neutropenia is lower in patients that are reporting regular physical activity. So I would add for this patient, I would encourage her as best she can with her functional status, which was good, to walk and to meet the ASCO guidelines for exercise in the older population.
Yeah, I mean, so definitely keep that in mind. You know, you marginate. I learned this from my transplant days. Your neutrophils marginate when you go to sleep. And so when you get up, if you check your labs first thing in the morning, which a lot of people do, you can be much more neutropenic. And I mean, it goes up by hundreds. So yeah, it's worth it. And you guys have great questions in here. The online geriatric assessment that's preferable that you would use?
I like the Cancer and Aging Research Group because they have multiple different assessments you can use. Right. I showed the CARG, I showed the breast cancer assessment, but they also have TT, which is toxicity, therapeutic toxicity, which is even more specific depending on which therapeutic you're using.
And then somebody asked if you could start at a lower dose and escalate, which we talked about earlier. I think we would all do that. But one quick last question, which is the male breast cancer. Do you give TAM and ribo? I just started a patient on TAM and ribo. It's like, okay, we're going to check your EKGs, but he's young, you know, 35, so 38 something, and had refused therapy for a year. Now has an ulcerated breast mass. So I'm like, I'm not putting you on, you know, an AI. So
I haven't had a situation where I had to do that. I've not had a young person, not that the older male patient would not be any different. And I have not had a scenario where I could not justify or they were very reluctant on the OSAI. So I have usually done OSAI with the ribo and not TAM ribo yet. But depending on a case, it's something is better than nothing. So I guess as long as I have a dialogue, I'm able to get the medication and I can monitor well, I'd be open to it if there is reluctance. But I have not had that situation and I would do OSAI preferably.
It's interesting that you raise that because I just for the very first time a month ago switched a male patient to the TAM-RIBO combination because of sexual dysfunction.
Yeah, that's what this.
Yeah, and,
for this young man.
And the patient was essentially saying to me that they were either going to completely discontinue therapy,
right. So
or if I had some other solution, they would try it. So we'll see how it goes.
As George Sledge always reminds us, you can only get a benefit if you take the drug. So if you want really some kind of benefit, then I will take that risk that comes with it and monitor them closely. But if I otherwise would prefer the medical way of doing it, would be OSAI.
Thanks to our supporters and to PER for all their work organizing this session. Thanks very much. Enjoy the rest of the evening.